So I'm going to talk about vortex core states and also impurity states in BSCO. It's a great privilege to have the opportunity to give this talk on behalf of my colleagues, Xuheng Pan and Eric Hudson, people who actually did the research work I'm going to talk about, and also the materials physicists Hiroshi Asaki, Shinichi Yoshida, Kwakwa Ying, and Anjan Gupta. Without those materials, this research would have been impossible. I'm going to talk about STM studies of BSCO. And to do those studies, we use a new low-temperature STM system built in Berkeley to work on this problem. It's an unconventional STM, a massive cryostat of the type used for helium-3 research, with a helium-3 refrigerator suspended below it, an STM in the core of a 7.25 approximately Tesla magnet. The STM is a Xuheng Pan design STM head, and it's the tip is right here in the center of the magnet. It can be, it operates between about 250 millikelvin and 40 Kelvin, up to a little bit above 7 Tesla. Importantly, we can exchange samples from room temperature while keeping everything cold. And when we introduce the samples, we can cleave them in cryogenic ultra-high vacuum and then immediately insert into the STM head. The principal utility for the purpose of this talk of using the STM is scanning tunneling spectroscopy. Let me just remind you of how that works. Here's the sample. Here's the tip. We bias the sample relative to ground, and we measure the current which tunnels from the tip to the sample. So here's a schematic of the density of states of some unknown material as a function of energy. There's the Fermi level in the sample. And if you bias the tip relative to the sample, you raise the Fermi level in the tip. And of course, you expose all these states here for tunneling into from the tip. Now, the thing of most utility is that if you raise the bias voltage by an amount dV, you expose these states over here for extra current dI. And of course, dI is dV multiplied by the density of states at that energy above the Fermi level in the sample. So what we measure is dI dV, the differential conductance, as a function of tip voltage. And this function is supposed to be proportional to the density of electronic states at that point. And of course, because it's a scan device, we can now measure this function as a function of position throughout the crystal. Here's the BSCO unit cell. It's very complicated, but we only have to deal with one surface in the STM, at least for BSCO, because when this crystal is cleaved at low temperatures and even at room temperature, these bonds here break and the bismuth oxide surface is exposed. So the bismuth atoms and the oxygen atoms are exposed on the surface. We just see the bismuth atoms in the STM image. The all-important copper-oxygen plane is 5 angstroms down here and one layer, one intervening layer below the surface. And you should note that underneath each bismuth atom is a copper atom. Now, when the crystal is cleaved and inserted into that instrument, here is an image, a pretty large field of view image of what one typically sees when it's a successful cleavage. It's a pretty complicated image. You can't see the atoms yet because there's, 10,000 of them in the field of view. You see the supermodulation, which is a static corrugation of the surface running along the B-axis of the crystal. And then you see this dark and light mottledness. And then there are additional features which are along the lines of maximum distortion in the supermodulation. By the way, please stop me and ask questions if you don't understand something that I show in the images. So here's a zoomed in image where we can now see this is the y-axis, a theorist's y-axis. This is a theorist's x-axis. These crystals, though, the crystallographic axis, this is the b-axis, and this is the a-axis for experimentalists. You can see that it's a square lattice, which on this surface is heavily distorted by the supermodulation. And zoom in some more. You see the individual bismuth atoms on the surface. There's Y and there's X. And a lot of the research is done in a field of view like this, where you see a few hundred bismuth atoms. OK, so what should we expect? Well, if we could get access to the copper-oxygen plane, of course, it's believed to have a dx squared minus y squared order parameter. There's a great deal of evidence for that. And the maximum in the gap is in the copper-oxygen bond direction, and the nodes in the gap are along the B and the A axis of the crystal at 45 degrees. If we had access to this plane, and if the gap had this structure here, then it's well known that the spectrum should look like this. Here are the coherence peaks at the gap edge, and it approaches zero linearly. Now, of course, we don't have access to that plane. We have access to the bismuth oxide plane here. So somehow, the superconductivity would have to tunnel up through these layers and then through vacuum into the tip. And in fact, some calculations have been done about precisely how that process can occur via the interlayer tunneling matrix element, and I'll come back to that later. When you clean these crystals and take the spectrum, a reasonably common spectrum looks like this. It slopes down from the, so negative sample bias is hole-like states. It slopes down from hole to particle-like states. You see the coherence peaks, they also slope down. You see these dips outside the coherence peaks and maybe some other features. A typical gap magnitude in the crystals we use is about 45 millielectron volts on average. So the first part of this talk is on the subject of substitution of zinc and nickel for a copper atom in the copper-oxygen plane, and the results, which the local electronic phenomena, which result from that substitution. These are very interesting atoms to substitute for the copper. So this is the vacuum state of these three atoms, but all of them are believed to end up in the crystal in the 2++ state, so they're still considered to have zinc when it's substituted, is believed to have spin zero, and nickel when it's substituted is believed to have spin one at the impurity site in the crystal. Now, there's been a very wide variety of theoretical work on this issue. I just show this graph because a big fraction of the people in the audience have worked on the problem of trying to understand what the impurity atoms do in a high TC superconductor. And I apologize, but I don't have enough time to review all the different contributions to this field. And even worse, there's no possibility of reviewing all the experimental results that have come out from impurity doping. I could just say that important results have come from NMR, neutron scattering, ARPAs, transport, thermal transport, microwave penetration depth experiments, a very wide variety of bulk results whose, in order to understand what they mean, we need to know what happens at the impurity atom in the crystal. So those are the motivations for doing this research. So one of the first theoretical proposals for a local effect at an impurity atom in D-wave VCS came here from Santa Barbara, from Doug Scalpino's group, Byers, Fletcher, and Scalpino. And they considered what happens near the gap edge as a function of position in space if you have an S-wave superconductor, and there's an impurity atom here, or a D-wave superconductor. And they showed that there should be a fourfold symmetric variation in the density of states, part of it oriented with the gap maxima, and part of it oriented with the gap nodes, somewhere here at this energy. Now, it turns out that this is an extremely challenging experiment to do on this one. And I wanted to show you the reason why. So here's a sample, 500 angstrom square. Here's a typical spectrum, let's say, on this sample. I chose this color scale here so that the what one would imagine to be the normal density of states at the Fermi level is the point where the color changes from gray to red. So the red regions are associated with where the coherence peaks are. So now if I map the density of states on this surface at 30 millivolts, which is just inside the coherence peak, we see a lot of inhomogeneity. Then near the average value of the gap magnitude, you see even more inhomogeneity. And then finally, when we go out to high energies, it goes away. So this makes it extremely difficult to measure the gap magnitude as a function of position. In this crystal here, there's about 25 impurity atoms, but we don't see a lot of response to them, at least trivially in these images. So the next interesting thing we might consider for the effect of the impurity atom on the D-wave superconductivity is a virtual bond state, or a scattering resonance. And here I just remind you of the properties of an impurity atom in a conventional metal. You can describe the perturbation as some potential here on site. Using Green's functions technique, you can define the Green's function related to the impurity potential. Then you can solve for this using this Lippmann-Schwinger type equation. If you know what this T matrix is here, then there's a theorem that shows that the perturbation in the local density of states at the impurity atom is related to the T matrix. And of course, for this to be large, you would like this to be large, so that the maximum perturbation occurs when there's a pole in the T matrix. So in a metal, if this potential is too weak to actually bind an electron below the conduction band, then you get what's called a scattering resonance, or a virtual bound state. It has an energy and a lifetime. You can think of it just as a tendency to localize an electron near the impurity atom. Now, in the context of D-wave superconductivity, Bielecki, Sapkowski, and Rosengren, and then Sapkowski, Bielecki, and Scalpino use this tool to understand what would happen at an impurity atom, and also what one should observe via STM type experiment. So they have an on-site impurity potential, which is a delta function with some strength. It's represented in this theory in, as C, which is proportional to 1 over U. The Green's function is known. One has to find the momentum average Green's function. I'll come back to that. The T matrix is known. The pole in the T matrix occurs when G, the free particle Green's function, equals plus or minus C, this variable. So that calculation can be made. So here's the condition under which the resonance should occur. It happens that only one solution is an intergap state. It happens that only one of these solutions is an intergap state. So for this type of order parameter, one can calculate what the momentum average Green function is, and then write down an analytic form for this result in the low energy limit, and then make the calculation for what the scattering resonance energy is and what the lifetime is. And the thing to note here is, aside from logarithmic corrections, the resonance energy goes as 1 over the potential. So as the scattering potential becomes strong, the resonance heads towards the Fermi level. Now here's a cartoon of that situation. If the scattering potential is of one sign, so let's say attractive for electrons, or U less than 0, then this theory predicts that an intergap impurity state would be generated at this site, and that it's got a peak only on one side of the spectrum. If U is less than 0, the peak is on the positive bias side, and if U is greater than 0, the peak is on the negative bias side. So if you could image the local density of states at this energy, the on-site component would be fourfold symmetric and oriented with the gap nodes, and it has this characteristic energy. So to search for these phenomena, Hiroshi Asaki and Uchida in University of Tokyo made, at Chuhang Pan's request, a series of crystals where the zinc atoms substituted the copper in about 0.6% of the cases. So when these crystals are cleaved and inserted into the STM, we don't see anything which really distinguishes them from the non-impurity atom crystals at the surface. There is this mottling, and you see the supermodulation, but you don't see the zinc atoms at the surface. So to find the effect of the zinc atoms, we would like to map precisely this same surface, but measure the density of states near the Fermi level. And no, all the topographic images I show are raw data. They're plane subtracted.
That's right, that wasn't the question. Yeah. If you have no zinc in there,
yeah,
can you tell the difference by looking at this,
no,
this scale?
No. But if you measure the density of states near the Fermi level, you can find the position of the zinc atoms. So this is the same field of view, but it's a map of the density of states at minus 1.5 millivolts. I'll show you why that value. Let me show you that again. So you don't see the atoms here, but if you measure the density of states near the Fermi level, there they are. Those are the zinc impurity atoms. So you see each one of these little impurity states, they're the same size, the same shape, the same orientation. This color scale here, dark would be zero density of states at the Fermi level. Blue is a few percent of the normal density of states at the Fermi level. And these white guys are a high density of states near the Fermi level. So to understand what's going on here, of course, we'd like to take the STM and go to the center of one of these impurity states and take the spectrum. And the spectrum looks like this. Here's the spectrum far away. And the red curve is the spectrum right at the center of the zinc impurity state. So you can see the coherent structure is more or less destroyed. Looks like there's a little residual gap here. Coherent structure is destroyed here as well. But there's a huge peak in the density of states at minus 1.5 millivolts, just a little bit away from the Fermi level. The tail crosses the Fermi level, so you can find these things by scanning at zero energy. So now we know what the characteristic energy is, so we can zoom in and take a high-resolution topograph and a simultaneous high-resolution map of the density of states of the impurity state. So the first thing we can note, we do note, is that the center of the impurity state always occurs at the site of a bismuth atom at the surface, and that's as it should be because the substitution copper site is underneath the bismuth site. This object is fourfold symmetric, and although it's saturated here, it's very bright. Most of the intensity in the spectral wave is oriented with the nodes of the dx squared minus y squared gap. Although we do see a lot of other complicated phenomena going on here. So we can map the properties of this impurity state as a function of energy. Here we're near the resonance. Here we cross the Fermi level. And the thing to notice here is actually that there's not very much to notice. The size and shape and orientation of this state does not change dramatically when we go from one side of the Fermi level to the other side of the Fermi level. Now, based on this simultaneous topography and density of states mapping, we can define the. We can try and understand if this impurity state is somehow related to the positions of the atoms in the CuO2 plane. So, to give us a feeling for where those atoms are, we lay a grid on the top surface. So, these are the bismuth atoms. We lay a grid on here to give us a feeling for where the copper atoms are. And then, if we lay the same grid over the impurity state, we can see clearly the impurity atom is right here. The first nearest neighbor copper atom positions are actually associated with a very weak response. Then the second nearest neighbor positions are associated with a stronger response, and the third nearest neighbor positions an intermediate response. It's a complicated psi squared of the wave function of this impurity state. And the last but probably quite as important piece of experimental information. So this is a graph of the data I showed you in the previous image, where we show how the density of states varies as a function of position. Here you see the whole spectrum varying as a function of position. There's the impurity state. Here's the coherence peaks. They're almost destroyed. As we go away in half angstrom steps, by the time we get 15 angstroms away, the coherence is basically recovered. 20 angstroms away is more or less indistinguishable from the bulk. So at the zinc atom, it looks like the coherence is very strongly suppressed or even destroyed. Okay, so is this state a unitary B-wave scattering resonance? Well, there's some very good agreement with this idea. The state exists. It's very near the Fermi level. The spatial location is consistent with substitution on the copper site. The density of states clearly breaks particle hold symmetry on site. The wave function is fourfold symmetric, and it is oriented with the dx squared minus y squared gap modes. And all of those are very satisfactory observations, but as many people in this room have pointed out to me over the last few months, there are several important disagreements between these observations and the idea of the scattering resonance. One is that unitary scattering should give zero density of states at the scattering site. Another one is that this state is not overall particle hold symmetric. Okay, the integrated density of states on the hole-like side is two orders of magnitude higher than the integrated density of states on the particle-like side. The numbers are actually not consistent for the line width. And finally, the coherence peaks are absent, so it looks like maybe superconductivity is destroyed in this region. So I'm going to come back to this question a little bit later. I'd like to compare for you the phenomena that occur at a magnetic impurity atom. So in principle, if one were to put a single magnetic impurity atom in here and define an impurity potential which looks like this, then the solution to this problem has been found in the D-wave BCS case, and the prediction is a particle hole symmetric spin polarized state here, which is four-fold symmetric. I'm not going to dwell on this because it does not appear to be the case that we observe at the Nichols site. We appear to have a more complicated situation where the on-site potential has potential scattering and magnetic interactions. So if you look at this equation here, there's two possible energies. There's U plus for spin down, let's say, and then U minus for spin up of the quasi particle. So one can represent this in the T-matrix scheme in this fashion. There's now two values of C. The T-matrix is as before. So the scattering resonance occurs for this solution. And if you work through the algebra, as these authors did, for the case where the potential scattering is bigger than the magnetic scattering, you get the following situation. You get two scattering resonances. They're spin polarized, and they occur at these two energies, which is basically 1 over the energy of the interaction on site. Here's a cartoon of that situation. You have an impurity atom. It's got a spin. It's got a charge. Let's assume that the potential is stronger than the magnetic interaction and that U is less than zero. Under those circumstances, you could think that the potential scattering generates an intergap resonance, one resonance, which is degenerate, spin up, spin down. And then the magnetic interactions lift the degeneracy and split that resonance into two lines. And that the energy of the lines is given by the equations I just showed you. So to search for these phenomena, again, Aisaki and Uchida, Kuroshi Aisaki to be precise, made these crystals which have 5.5% of the copper atoms substituted by nickel. And again, when they're inserted into the STM, the surface looks like this, the same model pattern, the same supermodulation, the same inability to see the impurity atoms at the surface. If we zoom in a little bit, this is the region we're going to study now in some detail. We'd like to search near the Fermi level for the impurity states associated with the nickel atoms. There should be about 40 of them in this field of view. And as soon as that search was made, in fact, we failed to find them at the Fermi level. There's only, let's say, 2 impurity states near the Fermi level in this sample. It's only about 5% of the expected density. So now we began searches at higher and higher and higher energies. We mapped the density of states at each sequential energy, searching for the energy where the nickel atoms generate the impurity states. And near 10 millivolts, indeed, we found them. And these states have the right aerial density. When the aerial density was changed in another batch of crystals, the aerial density of the observations changed by the same amount. These are the nickel states. And very interestingly, they have a particle-like and a hole-like component, which is really what one should expect. So here is the particle-like component of the nickel impurity state, and here's its hole-like companion. So now we'd like to go to one of these sites and take a high-resolution measurement of the spectrum. And now you see that here's the background spectrum. It's about 30 angstroms away. At the nickel site, the coherence peak here survives, but on the other side, you have two clear states at 9 and 19 millivolts. Again, we'd like to take a high-resolution topography and a simultaneous high-resolution image of the two particle-like and hole-like components of the states at those two energies. We can lay the grid over the topography to find out the relationship to the copper atom positions. And when we do that, we now see that here's the impurity atom. At positive bias, there is a four-fold symmetric state. It's oriented with the gap nodes, but it's associated with the impurity site and the 4 second nearest neighbors. The 4 nearest neighbors are dark in this image. They have very low density of states. If you look over here, though, the 4 nearest neighbor positions are very bright for the other bias. So this is a spatially complementary result, where the density of states is low here, it's high here, and vice versa. Now I'd like to explain how that complicated situation can come about. If we take the spectrum at the nickel site, it's this red curve. It's got a coherence peak and 2 impurity peaks on this side here. If we go to the first nearest neighbor atom, we get the blue curve. So the impurity peaks disappear on this side, but they appear on the other side. If we go to the second nearest atom, we get the green curve. The impurity peaks disappear on this side, but they appear over here. And the coherence peak is alternating on the opposite side. So here's the impurity peaks, and the coherence peak is over here. And then far away, you get the background spectrum. So it's a very complicated variation of spectra with position. But it turns out to be quite simple in some regards. If you take the average of all the spectra at all energies around this impurity state within a box which is about 20 angstrom square, the spectrum is particle hole symmetric. So this series of phenomena is precisely what has recently been calculated for the situation of a D-wave scattering resonance. It should be particle hole symmetric. It should be complementary in D-wave. And that's precisely what's observed. So here's a summary of what we know about the nickel impurity state. So on site, you have a coherence peak on this side and two impurity peaks on the other side. At the first nearest neighbor, the coherence peak changes side, and so do the impurity peaks. Second nearest neighbor, it reverses. There's the coherence peak, there's the impurity peaks. Then far away, it looks like this. The average of this whole object looks like that. Here are the energies of the states that are observed. So this complex of phenomena appears to be quite consistent with the D-wave scattering resonance picture of the situation. There are two impurity states. They're in the correct spatial location. Its weak scattering, U, turns out to be pretty small. So the fact that there's density of states on site is not a problem. It's non-unitary scattering. The wave function is four-fold symmetric. It's oriented with the gap nodes on site. The complementary part is rotated by 45 degrees. The numbers are reasonably consistent. The whole state is particle hole symmetric, and the coherence peak survives at this site. At the magnetic atom, it looks like the superconductivity is present right up to the atom. So, given the knowledge that, in fact, one can find an impurity state which seems to be perfectly consistent with the D-wave scattering resonance picture, we should ask ourselves, what actually is the impurity state at the zinc site? So there have been a variety of recent proposals. One is that it is a scattering resonance, but that the scattering potential needs to be extended, and maybe there's loss of particle hole symmetry in the unperturbed state. Another proposal is that it's basically a pseudo-gap impurity state. You suppress the Andreev coherence for the Cooper pairs in that region, and then you're left with a scattering resonance, but of the background electronic state. But actually, most attention recently has turned to the idea of a Kondo resonance. The reason for that is that there have been recent NMR experiments that show that when you put zinc atoms into the copper-oxygen plane, so you're putting a spin-zero atom into this plane, so it's spinless at the impurity site, and then the NMR experiments indicate that there is a spin-a-half localized nearby this impurity. And then, of course, if this is true, one might expect that the background electronic state would attempt to screen that spin half in a Kondo sense. So there's been, obviously, a very significant degree of work of trying to understand the Kondo effect in the context of the linear density of states approaching the Fermi level of a D-wave superconductor. Very recently, Subir Sachdev's group has succeeded in calculating the electronic structure that is associated with the spin structure, and it's reasonably consistent with what we actually see. But I think this is an open question. We don't know if this is a Kondo resonance or if it's some kind of a distorted scattering resonance. Okay, so the rest of my talk now, I'm going to change gears and describe studies of the electronic state of the vortex cores in BISCO. Now, as you all know, no doubt know, there should be bound quasiparticle states in the cores of S-wave vortices, as originally described by Karolyi et al. So Harald Hess was able to image these vortices, and also he was able to show, so here's the quasiparticle spectrum for niobium diselenide. As he approaches the vortex core, the peaks get suppressed, and a big peak in the density of states occurs at the Fermi level. These are the core states in the conventional S-wave superconducting vortex cores. We would like to understand what's the physics of such states in the context of high TC. So one possibility is that in a pure dx squared minus y squared order parameter, as originally described by Grishovolovic, there should be extended core states. They would give a peak in the density of states at the Fermi level. There would be fourfold symmetric oriented with the nodes, and they would decay as a power law, as a function of position. Now, the pioneering experimental work in this area was done by Austin Fischer's group. Maggio Aprilia et al. Were able to show that in YBCO, so here's the unperturbed spectrum. So in the presence of a vortex, the coherence peaks are destroyed, and there are these two states at plus minus 5 millivolts inside the YBCO cores. They could image the states at the gap energy by using a perturbation, let's say, to this signal here as a function of position. They could image the states. They could image the vortices. The diameter is about 100 angstroms. Now, in BISCO, the situation is a little bit different. Again, in Fischer's group, Christoph Ritter was able to image the vortex cores in BISCO. But in this case, although the cores could be imaged at the gap energy, no core states were reported in here. So here's far away and approaching the vortex core. They didn't see any core states in here. The diameter is about 100 angstroms. So we wanted to address this issue. Here again, in a black and white color scale, is a cleaved BISCO crystal. This one came from Kwakwa Ng's group. It has the same characteristics that we usually see of a clean surface. And now we would like to make spectroscopic maps of this field of view to find out what we can tell about the vortices. So here is a map at zero bias at the Fermi level, at zero Tesla with no magnetic field. So there are a significant number of impurity atoms in this crystal, and they create scattering resonances. And in this crystal, we don't know the identity of those atoms. But vortex cores is the focus of the research. So what I'd like to do is just turn on a 7 Tesla magnetic field now and see what happens at the Fermi level. And when you do that, you see a fairly significant addition to the density of states. I'm just flipping back and forth. So you can see two things. One thing is that the impurities shift a tiny amount as the sample shifts in the field. See them right there. But another thing is that new features appear. There's one. There's one. Those are the vortex cores. So we go to the vortex core center and try to take the spectrum. Now there's a variety of different phenomena. There are the scattering resonances, which can be identified a priori. There are regular regions which have no vortices and no scattering resonances, and there are vortex cores. Here's the various spectra. So here's the regular spectrum. Here's the scattering resonance spectrum. These were very weak resonances. And finally, the spectrum in the vortex core is really quite different. Here it is. The coherence peaks are suppressed, and there are additional states in the core. So here I compare side by side the different phenomena. The coherence peaks are destroyed on both sides. A gap spectrum clearly remains here. This is taken at 4 Kelvin. There's no zero bias conductance peak, and there definitely are additional low energy states in these cores. Now, we can try and image these states in the following fashion. The green curve is the regular spectrum. The red curve is the spectrum of an impurity state. And the difference between these two curves is the contrast for imaging the impurity states. So if we image at this energy here near the Fermi level, we get the maximum signal having to do with the scattering resonances. So more contrast for resonances at the Fermi level. On the other hand, the maximum difference between the regular curve and the vortex curve is here. It's around 7 millivolts on the average. If we image the surface at 7 millivolts, if we image the LDOS at 7 millivolts, we should have more contrast to see the vortex core states. So here again is the zero bias image in 7 Tesla that I already showed you. But if I turn to a 7 millivolt image, then it brings out the core states very clearly. So this is the tool that we're going to use to identify the location of the cores and to begin to measure their electronic structure. So here we are using this tool at several different fields. we can introduce more and more vortices. As a function of field, we can make these Voronoi diagrams and calculate the flux on average associated with each vortex. And when we do so, we find that the average flux is very close to one flux quantum. So this means that the 7 millivolt core states are associated with all vortices. Okay, so this is Professor Nishida from Tokyo Institute of Technology. And just imagine for a moment that I have been converted into he, because I want to show some transparencies from his recent work. So, very recently, within the last month or so, the Nishida group has been able to cleave the disco crystals in cryogenic ultra-high vacuum and see the surface, and also to image the vortex core states and show the position of the vortices. So when they take the spectrum at the center of one of those vortices, they see the following spectrum. So here's the spectrum far away from the vortex core, and here's the spectrum at the core as observed in the Tokyo Institute of Technology experiment. So again, you can see that there are core states here. These are underdoped crystals, and apparently in these crystals, the vortex lattice appears more ordered than it does in the impurity-doped crystals that we have been using at Berkeley. We're obviously using impurity-doped crystals because we were focusing on impurities. So here, the Nishida group believes that they can see a fourfold symmetric local order in the vortex lattice, imaged again at the vortex state energy. And here's a summary of what the points that Professor Nishida wished to make. They can see an ordered vortex lattice at 4.2 Kelvin by using the core state. They can see the core states free from the influence of defects and impurities. That's an important issue. The core states, they believe, have energy near 10 millivolts, but this is an underdoped crystal, so they could be at a different energy. And he stole one of my punchlines, which is that it means that the vortex core phenomenology will be unified for both YBCO and BISCO. Okay, let me convert myself back into myself now. So we would like to identify unpinned vortices in our crystal so that we can get some information about the vortex core structure. So here's the impurity state image at 0 volts and 0 tesla. You see there's nothing here, nothing here, and nothing there. And here's the high field, Here's the high field image. You can see there's a vortex core here, here, and here. They're unpinned. Now, in the zinc-doped crystals, we have a more challenging problem. Here are the zinc impurity states, and here's the simultaneous measurement, not simultaneous, but the same field of view measurement at 7 millivolts and 7 tesla. There's about 450 impurity states here and 175 vortex cores. It's a bit difficult to correlate them. But one can do it by cutting out, just drawing a circle for the position of each vortex core and laying it on top of the impurity map, and then you can find a relatively small number of vortices that are not pinned. That's important because we would like to understand their structure. So here's what we do to find the core state structure. Let's take a vortex which is unpinned. We identify the center. Then we take the azimuthally average local density of states. So take the center and just find the radial density of states by making an azimuthal average. We can plot that azimuthal average as a function of radius. For an unpinned vortex, it looks like this. Now, this is actually a rather good fit to an exponential with a decay length of 24 angstroms, plus an offset, and this offset makes good sense. It's the 7 millivolt density of states of a D-wave superconductor. There should be an offset there at infinity. Yes?
What is an unpinned vortex?
It's a vortex which, in our experiments, has no scattering resonance at the same site. Okay? To the extent that it's going to influence my conclusions, it doesn't matter, because here's a thin vortex, a vortex that has an impurity resonance, let's say, at the center. If we plot the radially average density of states here, it also decays exponentially to an offset. But at low radii, it's highly perturbed by the scattering resonance. So using these tools, we analyzed it, you know, equivalent numbers. It was difficult to find a large number of unpinned vortices. So these are the ones we analyzed. And this is basically after azimuthal averaging and subtracting the offset, which is the same for all vortices in any crystal, but different in different crystals. This is the result. And for 8-pinned vortices, this is the result here. They're really in very good agreement with each other for radii bigger than about 15 angstroms. So here's the radial dependence of the core state density of states. It decays exponentially with a decay length of 22 plus or minus 3 angstroms. This is unpinned vortices. Pinned vortices, once you go out of beyond about 15 angstroms, they're indistinguishable. The core states are the same. Now, what explanation could we have for this situation? Well, several different ones have been discussed. A recent one is that, in fact, there are extended states in the copper-oxygen plane, but via the interlayer tunneling matrix element, they get perturbed to give this series of observation in the bismuth oxide plane. And at present, I don't think we could distinguish whether or not this is true. It's an excellent suggestion. The suggestion with the longer history, and which has been worked on by more people, is that locally, in a vortex core, a D plus IS or D plus ID order parameter is induced. You have an induced local gapless superconductor. In that case, there are no nodes in the gap. You can, in principle, have bound states in the core, and they would decay exponentially with radius. So that's a quite satisfying picture of the situation. But as Sasha Bolatsky and Kazumi Maki both pointed out to us, there is a problem here. It's that if the energy of the core states is 7 millivolts and the decay rate is 22 angstroms, the induced secondary order parameter would have to be around 15 millivolts. And that's a very large secondary order parameter. Okay. Nonetheless, from the experimentalist point of view, at least we can say that now there's a common phenomenology for vortex cores in high TC. The coherence peaks are destroyed in YBCO as they are in DISCO. Core states appear in YBCO as they do in DISCO. One can image the vortex lattices or pinned vortices, depending on the impurity level. And at least in BISCO, we can see that these states appear to be bound in the cores. So that's the end, I think, of what I want to say about vortex core states. Here's my summary, just in time. So the electronic nanoscape of these materials is really, you like it? It's really very complicated. We can get the D-wave spectrum at the bismuth oxide surface, but there's a lot of inhomogeneity in this spectrum. We can find the vortex cores in the presence of a field, and perhaps they do give some evidence for D plus IS or D plus ID. We can find these zinc impurity states, which maybe they're scattering resonances, or maybe they're a Kondo effect in the D-wave superconductor. And finally, we can find these nickel scattering resonances. So here's Xuheng Pan. I think it's fair to say that these experiments would have been impossible without Xuheng Pan. He built the beautiful STM that we use for this work, and he carried out the vortex core experiments that I just told you about, and also the zinc impurity state experiments. Another person who deserves a lot of credit is Eric Hudson. He was in charge of the cryogenics and also the software that made these experiments possible. And during his postdoc, he carried out the study of the nickel impurity states that I described. Both of these guys, unfortunately for me, have gone on to bigger and better things. But I have a new team now working on this instrument, Vidya Madhavan and Christine Lang, and I can only hope that they will be as productive as the previous colleagues. So on behalf of my colleagues here, and also Uchida, Aisaki, In, and Gupta, thank you very much for listening to me.
anywhere relative to the peak of the trough of the modulation of the bismuth oxide layer?
Yes. There are effects from the position of the atoms in the top surface. But the statistics for those effects is not very large, because we don't have a large number of high resolution studies.
The part you don't go to your zinc paper.
Which piece?
The one where you see the zero bias peak on the subway.
Almost there. There we go.
There. Okay, now, as you know, I am what is a Condor resonance picture, but first of all, let me point out the following. The Condor resonance, if it exists, will not be a zero energy. It will be probably the little picture which you're seeing down below there.
But this peak here is not at zero energy. It's at minus 1.5 millivolts. The reserve to distinguish it from zero is very high. It's definitely not at zero.
Okay, so it's not at zero.
It's definitely not at
zero. That's one of the things that's wrong. Do you see any features behind it?
In the zinc atoms, no. Of course, it does cross the Fermi level here, about at this level.
Yes.
So there is a residual effect.
But is it clear that it's an effect of the zinc atom itself?
Well, it has the same spatial structure as it crosses the Fermi level, so it's probably the tail.
The zinc atom is damaging the superconductivity, so it's conceivable that you, there too, you make it a stability order parameter, and you make it in a layer of tail.
Yeah.
And it's something that we can think of Dora and Green Street and Mountain, so you could get something similar.
In the vortex core that you told us about, do you see any evidence of antiferromagnetism or any evidence that it would look like the underdoped system in some way?
In this project that I described here, we didn't have enough spatial resolution to answer that question.
It looks like a pseudo spectrum itself. The module of the bounce
net
looks like a
pseudo gap in the moment. At the risk of saying the same things I said in Trieste to the same talk, it's a different audience. Two comments. One is that, actually I guess I didn't say this at the talk, I said it later. One is that if Ole Anderson is right, tunneling to the bismuth should be the same as should act the same as interlayer tunneling. And so, if you have amplitude on a particular copper atom, you should see the amplitude on the neighboring copper atom. So that, or neighboring bismuth, the bismuth that is above the neighboring copper atom. So the tunneler, the amplitude should be thought of as displaced by one lattice constant from the actual amplitude on the copper plane. Because the dx squared minus y squared don't tunnel efficiently, only the ds on the neighboring copper. So that in thinking about these things, one should be thinking, one should be translating it back. In particular, the bright spot on the zinc probably means that you have strong amplitude on the four neighboring sides to the zinc, which would agree with our little, as a matter of fact.
Could I respond to that?
Yeah.
I mean, one comment I made about there was result at the nickel atom. So here, there we go. So these are several different theoretical techniques here, which calculate the density of states for the impurity state in the CuO2 plane. Okay, and they predict an object which looks remarkably like this object.
Yeah.
Spectral weight is balanced, it's complementary, it's a D-wave scattering resonance.
I wouldn't worry about the theory.
Yeah, okay. But so my comment was going to be, this object is not observed in the CuO2 plane, it's observed in the BIO plane. So there is some implication for the properties of the matrix element in there.
The other comment was, in the very first slide you showed, you show this interesting, or almost the very first, energy distribution. It has this interesting particle-hole asymmetry, which is not, in fact, a straight line, but actually looks rather like an S-curve. That particle-hole asymmetry in that form is one of the very first things one that we ever suggested, invalidate or at least make you very dubious about Fermi liquid theory, because such a thing doesn't happen in Fermi liquid theory. There is within Fermi liquid theory no particle hole symmetry. And the fact that this appears at high energies means that the lack of Fermi liquidness is really a phenomenon that pervades the entire energy scale.
Okay, one more question.
Do you
want to comment on that?
No,
one more question from Lloyd.
One thing that helps differentiate between, you know, when I look at the surface bound states and then I see evidence of the localized one that you look at, might be separated by field dependence. And I have no idea, and I've never seen data on what the field dependence is. I don't know what's predicted or what you see for the field dependence on either the zinc belt or the two nickel resonance.
Okay, so I can comment on just the challenge of answering that question. when you turn on the, as I showed you, when you turn on the field, you fill the field of view with vortices. So you have a scattering resonance, okay? Any given scattering resonance is in the proximity of several vortices. So it's a challenging project to, let's say, find one which is embedded in the core reliably, or one which is at a fixed distance from n known vortices, and then, you know, extract. What I'm saying is there's an interaction probably between the electronic states of the vortex
core. So if you're sitting on one of these nickel zinc resonances, yeah, and you apply even a small field,
yeah,
do nothing's move that you can't track with them?
No, nothing. There's any response is weak.
Up to what field?
Pardon?
We'll have time for discussion later. Thanks.